Then there's keeping an older child out of sight. It's a lot harder to explain a 2-year-old suddenly appearing to friends and family. If you were snatching a child of that age to raise as your own, you'd have to disappear too. And the tailors haven't budged.
Quite right. Fry, is it?
Sparks said, waving him to sit down. The other teams had ruled out kidnap for cash or revenge. Dawn Elliott didn't have any money of her own. They trawled back through her teenage years for previous boyfriends and evidence of drugs or prostitution in case there was an organized crime connection. But there was nothing. She was a small-town girl who'd worked in an office until she'd fallen for a married man and become pregnant. They still hadn't found Bella's father. The name he gave Dawn looked like it was false, and the mobile phone number was for a pay-as-you-go that no longer rang.
"He's a chancer, boss," Matthews said. "Just out for a bit of extramarital, and then disappears. The life of 1,000 travelling salesmen, a shag in every town."
Pedophiles was all that was left on the board. The energy leached out of the room.
"Meanwhile, back to Glenn Taylor," Sparks said.
"And Mike Doonan," Matthews muttered. "What about Operation Gold?"
But his superior officer appeared not to hear him. He was listening to his own fears. Personally, Sparks was certain Glenn Taylor was already thinking about his next victim, fueling his thoughts with internet porn. Looking at these images becomes an addiction, as hard to kick as a drug, according to psychologists. Sparks had been told the reasons blokes became dependent on internet porn: depression, anxiety, money troubles, work problems, and some of the theories about the chemical payoff, the thrill produced by adrenaline, dopamine, and serotonin. One report he read as homework compared viewing porn to the rush of first-time sex for some men, leading them to chase a repetition of the same high with more and more extreme images. A bit like how cocaine addicts describe their experience, it had added. Surfing on the net opened up a safe fantasy world full of excitement, a way of creating a private space in which to offend.
"Interestingly," Sparks told Matthews later, as they sat in the cafeteria, "not all porn addicts get erections."
Ian Matthews raised an eyebrow as he rested his sausage sandwich on the formica table.
"Do you mind, boss? I'm eating.
What are you reading there? Sounds like complete bollocks."
"Thank you, Professor," he snapped. "I'm trying to get inside Glenn Taylor's murky little world. We're not getting in there through interviews, but he won't be able to stay away from his habit. I'll be waiting for him. We'll find him and catch him."
His sergeant sat back heavily and resumed chewing on his lunch.
"Go on, then. Tell me how." "Fry, one of the clever kids they've sent us to knock into shape, came to see me yesterday. He says we've missed a potential trick. Chat rooms. That's where porn addicts and sexual predators look for friends and lose their inhibitions."
Detective Constable Fry had paid a visit to his senior officer's office, pulling up a chair without being invited, and treating the conversation like an Oxbridge tutorial.
"The problem, as I see it, is we need disclosure from Glenn Taylor."
"No shit, Sherlock," Sparks thought.
"Go on, Fry." "Well, perhaps we need to enter his world and catch him at his most vulnerable."
"I'm sorry, Fry. But can we cut to the chase? What are you going on about? His world.
I bet he's on the prowl in chat rooms, probably looking for new prospects. And he could disclose some key evidence to us if we pose as punters. We could put in a chiss."
Sparks raised an eyebrow.
"Sorry?
A covert human intelligence source, to watch him at work. We covered it at college, and I think it's well worth a try." He finished, uncrossing his long legs and leaning on Sparks's desk. Sparks had automatically leaned back, physically and mentally. It wasn't that Fry was cleverer than him, It was the confidence the younger man had that he was right that needled him. That's what university does for you, he thought.
Bloody university education, he could hear his dad say. Waste of bloody time. It's for people with money and nothing to do. Not you, was the message to the 17-year-old with an application form in his hand.
There'd been no further discussion on the subject. His dad was a clerk at the district council and preferred his world small and known. Security was his watchword, and he urged his son to have the same lower-middle-class mindset.
Get your A-levels and get a nice office job, Robert. Job for life.
Bob had kept his application to the police secret from both his parents. Funny, he always thought of them as one person, Mum and Dad, and presented it as a fait accompli when he was accepted. He didn't use the words fait accompli. His mum and dad didn't hold with foreign stuff. He'd done well with the police, but his rise was not meteoric. That wasn't how things were done in his day. So it was words like committed, insightful, and methodical that punctuated his appraisals and recommendations. The new breed of graduates on fast-track entry would cringe if they were described in the same way, Sparks thought.
Tell me about chat rooms, Sparks said,
and Fry, who looked like he barely shaved, let alone went looking for sex on the internet, told him he had written a dissertation on the subject.
My psychology tutor is researching the effects of pornography on personality. I'm sure she'd help us, he'd said.
By the end of the week, Sparks, Matthews and Fry were on their way to the young officer's alma mater in the Midlands. Dr. Fleur Jones greeted the senior officers at the lift door and looked so young, the detectives thought she must be a student.
We're here to talk to Dr. Jones, Matthews said, and Fleur laughed, used to, and secretly enjoying, the confusion created by her dyed red hair, pierced nose, and short skirts.
That's me. You must be D.I. Sparks and Sergeant Matthews. Nice to meet you.
Hello, Daniel. The three men squeezed their joint bulk into the utilitarian booth that served as Fleur Jones's workspace, and two began scrutinizing the walls out of habit. The message board was covered in childish drawings, but when Sparks and Matthews focused in on the detail, they realized they were looking at pornographic images.
Good grief, Bob Sparks said. Who the hell did these? Not your usual kindergarten artworks.
Dr. Jones smiled patiently, and Fry smirked.
Part of my research, she said. Getting habitual pornography users to draw what they witness online can reveal personality traits, and lets them see things differently, perhaps enabling them to see the human beings behind the sexual objects they seek out.
Right, said Sparks,
wondering what the sex offenders in his area would produce, given crayons.
Well, Dr. Jones, we don't want to take too much of your valuable time, so shall we get down to the reason we're here?
The psychologist crossed her bare legs and nodded intently, eye contact unwavering. Sparks tried to mirror the body language, but he couldn't cross his legs without kicking Matthews, and he started to feel a bit hot. Dr. Jones rose and cracked open her window.
Getting a bit stuffy in here, sorry. It's a small room.
Sparks cleared his throat and began.
We're investigating the disappearance of Bella Elliott, as D.C. Fry has told you. We have a suspect, but we're looking for new approaches to find out if he took the child. He has an extensive interest in sexual images of children and adults dressed as children. There are images on his computer. He says he didn't download them intentionally.
Dr. Jones allowed herself a twitch of a smile of recognition.
He's very manipulative, and is turning our interviews into a masterclass in evasion.
Addicts are brilliant liars, Inspector.
They lie to themselves and then to everyone else. They're in denial about their problem,
And they are experts at finding excuses and other people to blame, Dr. Jones said. Dan tells me you are interested in trying to interact with the suspect in sex chat rooms.
She can't be more than 30, Sparks thought.
The psychologist clocked the pause and smiled knowingly.
Yes, that's right. But we need to understand much more about these chat rooms and how to approach our man, he said quickly.
There followed a lecture on finding sexual partners online, with the older detectives following with difficulty. It wasn't that they were computer illiterates. It was that the close proximity of Dr. Jones and her restless legs was far too distracting to allow full concentration. In the end, Dan Fry took over, using the psychologist's computer to take his bosses into a cyber fantasy world.
It's basically instant messaging, sir, he explained. You sign into a chat room that advertises itself as for singles, say, or teenagers, use a nickname to hide your real identity, and you can communicate with everyone else in that room, or just one person. You just start chatting by writing texts.
They can't see each other? Matthews asked.
No, you could be anyone. That's the attraction for predators. They can assume a new identity, or gender, or age group. Wolf in sheep's clothing, Fry told them.
Once contact was established with a likely individual, a young teen perhaps, the predator might persuade her to give her email address so grooming could go on in private.
Once they have one-to-one contact, anything is possible. For consenting adults, that isn't a problem, but some youngsters have been tricked or manipulated into posing for explicit photographs using a webcam. The predator can then blackmail them into other acts. Young lives ruined, Fry added.
Lesson over, Sparks had a go in an over-18s chat room. Matthews had suggested Super Stud as his nickname and snorted when his boss opted instead for Mr. Darcy, Eileen's favourite. But Darcy was greeted by a flurry of flirty messages from would-be Elizabeth Bennets that quickly escalated into direct sexual propositions.
Bloody hell, he said as the explicit messages scrolled up the screen. A bit in your face for Jane Austen, isn't it?
Dr. Jones laughed from behind him. He signed himself out and turned to face the expert.
But how do we find Glenn Taylor? He asked. There must be hundreds of these chat rooms.
Fry had his plan ready.
Yes, but we've got his computer, and so we can find out where he's been. Taylor's clever, and when Operation Gold started to bite, he deleted files and data. But it's all still there on the hard drive. Invisible to him, but very visible to the blokes in the forensics lab. They have dug out all sorts of information, and we know where he hangs out.
It sounded too good to be true, but Sparks found himself nodding, seduced by the mental picture of Taylor's face when he arrested him. He could almost smell the fox-like stench of Taylor's guilt. He tried to focus on the practicalities.
"We being who, exactly?" he asked.
"Fleur and I would work out a character, a backstory, and a script with some trigger words to use," DC Fry said, pink with excitement at the prospect of real detective work. Dr. Jones murmured her assent.
It could be very valuable for my research.
It felt signed and sealed, but Matthews piped up with a question no one had asked.
Is it legal?
The others in the room looked at him.
Will it stand up as evidence in court, sir? It could be seen as entrapment, Matthews pressed.
Sparks wondered if Matthews was reacting to the new boy's clever dickery. He didn't know the answer, but Fry gave him a possible way out.
We don't have a case to destroy, from what I've seen, sir. Why don't we see how far we get first? Then we can revisit this question, he said.
Matthews looked unhappy, but Sparks nodded his agreement.
Chapter 22. The Widow. Tuesday, June 12th, 2007. Funny things, birthdays. Everyone seems to love them, but I dread them. The build-up, the pressure to be happy, to have a good time, the disappointment when I don't. I'm 37 today, and Glenn is downstairs doing a tray of breakfast. It's still early, and I'm not hungry yet, so the food will be like sawdust in my mouth. But I'll have to tell him I love it. Love him. I do. I do. He's my world. But every birthday I wonder if maybe this year there'll be a miracle and we'll have a baby. I try not to think about it, but birthdays are difficult. It's that moment when you realize another year's gone past, isn't it? I know there's everything else going on, but I can't help it. We could adopt from abroad. I've seen all these articles about babies from China, but I can't say anything to Glenn without upsetting him. Here he comes. I can hear the cups and plates rattling on the tray. He's all smiles, and there's a red rose in a vase beside the boiled egg. He sings happy birthday as he comes around to my side of the bed, putting on a funny voice to make me laugh. Happy birthday, dear Jeannie. Happy birthday to you, he croons, and kisses me on the forehead, nose and mouth. It makes me cry, and he shifts the tray off my lap and sits so he can put both arms around me. Sorry, love. Don't know what's wrong with me, I say, trying to smile. He shushes me and goes to get his card and present from the wardrobe. It's a nightie. White broderie on glaze with pink bows. Like a little girl's. It's lovely, I say, and give him a kiss. Thank you, darling. Try it on, he says. Later. Need the loo. I don't want to put it on. I go to the bathroom and take a genie pill. I hate birthdays. Just before Bella's birthday in April, the first since she went missing, I went to Smith's to buy a card for her. I spent ages looking at the pictures and messages, and I picked one with Teletubbies and a badge. I am three, because I read in the papers that she liked them best. I didn't know what to write, so I went and sat on a bench in the park to think about her. I don't feel sad because I know she's alive. Her mother and I believe she's alive. So does Glenn. We think a couple whose child died took her and went abroad. I wonder if the police have thought of that. I expect Glenn's told them his theory. So I write, Dearest Bella, happy birthday. I hope you are home soon. And some kisses. I address it to her, Miss Bella Elliott. I don't know the number of her house, but I expect the postman will know. The mother says she gets dozens of letters every day. She said on Woman's Hour that some of them are nasty letters from mad people telling her she deserved to lose Bella. One of those must be mine. I wrote at the beginning, when I was so angry with her for leaving Bella on her own, when I couldn't even have a baby. I wanted her to know how wrong she'd been. I didn't sign that one either. I put a stamp on the birthday card, all bumpy with the badge inside, and walked home the postbox way. On the day, April 28th, Dawn was on breakfast television, with a little cake with three candles. She was wearing the birthday badge I sent with her Find Bella badge. She thanked everyone for the lovely cards and presents, and said she wasn't unwrapping them until Bella comes home. The woman doing the interview got all choked up. I unwrapped the present I bought for her, a baby doll with golden hair and a white and pink dress, and put her on my bed. I could do it because Glenn wasn't here. He'd gone out for a drive. He wouldn't be back for ages. And until then I could spend time with Bella. I have photos of her from the papers, and nice colour ones from magazines. I decided not to put her in the scrapbooks, because she's real and special, and I hope to meet her one day, when she comes home. I plan it, how we'll meet in the park, and she'll know it's me, and come running over, laughing and nearly tripping over. She's running so fast. Her little arms will wrap around my legs, and I'll bend down and pick her up and swing her around. It's my favourite daydream, but it's beginning to take over my day. Sometimes I find myself sitting at the kitchen table and the clock shows I've been there for more than an hour, and I don't remember the time passing. Sometimes I find I'm crying, but I don't know why, exactly. I went to the doctor to talk to him. I didn't mention Bella, but he knew all about Glenn's circumstances, as he put it, and I came away with a new prescription. "You need some peace of mind, Mrs. Taylor," he said, tearing it off his pad. "Have you thought about taking a break from what's happening?" He meant well, but there is no break to be taken. I can't stop the thoughts by catching a plane somewhere. I don't control them, or anything, anymore. I'm a passenger, not the driver, I wanted to tell him. Anyway, the pills should let me carry on being Jeannie when I need to be. Bella's mom is on the telly all the time. She's being interviewed on every talk show, spewing out the same old stuff about her angel and how she cries herself to sleep every night. She never misses an opportunity. I wonder if she's getting paid. I raise the question on a radio phone-in late at night. Chris from Catford comes straight on the line to back me up. "What kind of mother is she?" he screeches. I'm glad other people see through her. Since retiring, as Glenn calls it, I spend my days watching daytime telly, doing word searches in puzzle books, and taking part in radio phone-ins. Funny, I used to think that the radio was for brainy people, all that talking. But I started to put the local commercial stations on for company, and I got pulled in. There is a sort of gang of people who phone in, the same voices week in, week out. The old bloke who wants all immigrants thrown out, the woman who can't say her ass, who thinks politicians should be put in prison, the young lad who blames women for the rise in sex crime. They start out angry and their voices get higher and louder as they work themselves up. It doesn't matter what the subject is. They can be outraged, and I got addicted to it. I finally picked up the phone one day when they were discussing whether paedophiles could be cured. I said my name was Joy and told the presenter that paedophiles should be strung up. It went down well because there were loads of calls agreeing. And that was it. I was one of them. I changed my name every week or so. Anne, Kerry, Sue, Joy, Jenny, Liz. It was brilliant being someone else, even for 90 seconds. And having someone listen to you without knowing who you're married to and judging you. I found I had lots of opinions. I could be Mrs. Angry or a bleeding heart liberal, as Glenn puts it. I could be anyone I wanted. And it stopped me being lonely. Of course, Lisa had disappeared, with the rest of my life. At first, she kept calling round and inviting me in. She wanted to know all about it and was so sweet to me. She said she didn't believe a word of it. But the kids didn't come around anymore. There was always an excuse. Kane had a cold. Daisy was practicing her ballet for an exam. Lisa's sister was coming to stay. Then she nailed the gate shut. Just one nail, high up. "I was worried about break-ins," she said. "You understand, Jeannie." And I tried to.
Chapter 23. The Detective. Monday, June 18th, 2007. Over the weekend, Dan Fry and Fleur Jones had picked the name Jodie Smith. Jodie, because they thought it had a childlike ring to it, and Smith for anonymity. Jodie was a 27-year-old woman from Manchester, a junior secretary in a large office who'd been abused as a child by her father and who got a sexual thrill from dressing up as a child for sex. "It's hardly subtle," Sparks had commented when presented with the first draft of the lurid backstory. "He'll see straight through this. Couldn't we tone things down a bit? Anyway, why would a woman who's been sexually abused want to relive that as an adult?" Fry sighed. He was impatient to get going, finally get his teeth into some real police work, instead of acting as the incident room gopher. But he could sense the mood was changing in the room. The DI was in retreat. "That's a good question, sir," he said, using his favourite positive reinforcement technique. Sparks thought Fry was a patronising little twat, but decided to hear him out. The younger officer pointed out that Jody was modelled on an actual case study, and there followed a detailed psychological analysis of motives, post-traumatic stress disorder, acting out, and the darker side to human sexuality. Sparks looked impressed and interested, his misgivings pushed back into a recess for the time being.
"What does Dr. Jones say? Has she signed off on this?" he asked.
"Yes, well, almost, sir," Fry said. "I read the final draft to her on the phone this morning, and she seemed happy with it. I'm sending it by email in a minute for her comments."
"Okay. Once we have her approval, we'll present the strategy to the DCI," Sparks said.
Detective Chief Inspector Breakspear loved new ideas. Innovation was his byword, along with a clutch of other management clichés. And crucially, he was as determined as Sparks to nail Taylor.
"This could make our names," he said, rubbing his hands together as he heard them out. "Let's take it to the Chief Super."
It was decided to put the whole team before Chief Superintendent Parker. The meeting was a classic. Dr. Jones arrived wearing what looked like pajamas, a diamond glinting in one nostril. And C.S. Parker, in full uniform and brill cream, sat behind his Master of the Universe desk. He listened in silence as DCI Breakspear outlined the plan and the risk assessment and quoted the necessary legislation to go undercover, then blew his nose and said,
"Where's the evidence that this will work? Has anyone else tried it? Sounds like entrapment to me."
Breakspear, Sparks and Fry took turns offering answers, and Dr. Jones interjected with scientific data and charm. Finally, C.S. Parker put up his hands and pronounced judgment.
"Let's give it a try. If we don't get the evidence here, it sounds like we're unlikely to ever get it to put in front of a jury. Let's make sure we have clean hands, no prompting or leading. Everything done by the book. We'll get the evidence and then see if the judge allows it. Let's face it. If Taylor takes us to a body, it won't matter how we got it."
He called Sparks back in after the others had left to ask him about Fleur Jones.
"Is she flaky, Bob? She looked like she got dressed in the dark, and we are trusting her as our expert. How will she stand up to cross-examination?"
Sparks sat down again.
"Very well, sir. She knows her stuff, has degrees and research papers coming out of her ears."
Parker looked dubious.
"She's an expert in sexual deviance and frequently works with criminals,"
Sparks ploughed on.
"And that's just the university staff."
The joke fell to the ground, writhing.
"Right," the chief super said. "Okay, she's qualified, but why her and not our own people?"
"Because she's got an excellent working relationship with Fry already. He trusts her. And she'll look good in front of a jury."
"This is on your head, Bob. Let's see how she gets on. But make sure you are there every step of the way."
Sparks closed the door quietly. He joined Fleur Jones and the others in the forensic lab for a tour of Glenn Taylor's virtual playground. It was not an edifying experience, but Dr. Jones seemed the least affected. They stood behind the technician as he scrolled through the websites and chat rooms they had found on Taylor's hard drive during their first search, spotting his favourites, the times when he visited, length of stay, and other helpful habits. Lolita XXX seemed to be top of his list of porn sites, and he hung out in teen fun and girls' lounge chat rooms, using five different identities, including Who's the Daddy and Big Bear. Matthew smirked.
"Not Mr. Darcy, then, boss."
Taylor's public chats were fairly innocuous, flirtatious, and jokey, the sort of small talk you'd hear at a teenage party. The more explicit stuff happened away from the chat rooms. The inbox of an email address used only for his sexcursions, as Taylor called them in his emails, offered up a far more sinister glimpse into his secret world. Here, he persuaded others to join him. According to the photos sent to him, some were teens and others adults, but they all looked like kids. Sparks asked for a printout of all the chatroom conversations and private emails, and Fry took them away to confer with Dr. Jones.
"Is he up to this?" Matthews asked. "He's only just got here. He's got no operational experience."
"I know, but he's got the knowledge.
And we'll be there every step of the way.
Let's give him a chance," Sparks answered.
"You're going to call yourself Goldilocks?
Are you sure?"
Matthews laughed when Fry and his tutor reappeared in Sparks's office. Fry nodded.
"We think it will speak to his interest in children and fantasy," he explained.
"Bloody hell.
Bet he doesn't fall for that one."
But he did.
Goldilocks met Big Bear and flirted discreetly for a week. Dan Fry and Ian Matthews sat for hours in front of a computer screen, their working life compressed into a tiny room in the forensics department, lit by a buzzing fluorescent tube, with Jody's life story pasted up on a wall beside them. Fry had found a photo of a girl he'd admired at college on Facebook and had an enlargement of her face stuck just above the screen.
"Hi, Goldie. How's things? How are you feeling tonight?"
Sparks, occasionally watching over his shoulder, felt a mixture of excitement and nausea as the nightly tango with Glenn Taylor continued. Fleur Jones had given Dan Fry extensive coaching, and she was on the end of the phone if they needed her. But even with Matthews in the room, Sparks worried that his newest recruit must feel very alone. He'd gone out on a limb, and Sparks realized it was all about pushing himself up the ladder. But he knew it could also finish him if it went wrong.
"It'll work," Fry kept saying when spirits dipped.
Occasionally, another member of the team would put their head around the door.
"Shagged him yet?"
one asked Fry.
"Has he asked what colour your eyes are?"
said another. Matthews had laughed, joined in the joke, but Sparks realized the young detective had become a sideshow. He saw one night that Fry had caught a glimpse of himself reflected in the window behind the desk. He pushed back from the keyboard and was sprawled, legs splayed and spine curled back into the chair. Perhaps realizing that he was probably the mirror image of his quarry, Fry straightened up instinctively. Fry was also having to engage with other blokes, at least he thought they were blokes, in the room so Taylor didn't feel singled out, and the puerile humour and endless innuendo was beginning to wear him down. He could picture them, he said, heavy metal T-shirts and bald spots. Sparks began to worry that being the bait would prove too much for Fry. He couldn't fault the younger man for his commitment. He found Fry leafing through women's magazines to get in character and starting to talk about premenstrual tension, much to Matthew's disgust. And it was all taking so long. After 15 nights in the chat room, Matthews was getting restless and told his boss it was a waste of time.
"What do you say, Daniel?" Sparks asked.
It was the first time he'd used the junior officer's first name, and Fry realized he was being put in the driver's seat.
"We're building a relationship with him because we don't want it to be a quick sex session. We want him to talk. Why don't we give it another week?"
Sparks agreed, and Fry, glowing with a new sense of power, rang his former tutor to urge her to up the ante. She was doubtful at first, but they agreed that Jody should play hard to get and disappear for a couple of days, and then hit Glenn hard.
"Where have you been?"
Big Bear asked when Goldilocks reappeared. "Thought I'd lost you in the woods." "My dad said I was on the computer too much," Goldilocks said. "He punished me." Both knew by then that she was 27, but the game was on.
"How?"
"Don't want to say. I might get into trouble again."
"Go on."
And so she did. BB, as she now called him, was hooked.
"Why don't we meet up?"
somewhere online where your dad will never find us, he suggested.
Chapter 24 The Detective Tuesday, July 10th, 2007 Glenn Taylor said he was tapping the key softly, telling his new friend that everyone in the house was asleep apart from him. Goldie, as he now called her, had sent a photo of herself in baby doll pajamas, and he was trying to persuade her to take them off. D.I. Sparks had asked Fleur Jones to be present during all the private email sessions with Taylor, and they sat behind Dan Fry, barely lit by the glow of the screen. "You are so sweet, Goldie, my lovely girl. You're bad baby girl. You know I'll do what you want." "That's right, my bad baby girl." There followed a series of instructions from BB that Goldie told him she was obeying and enjoying. When it was over, Dan Fry took the next step. It wasn't what Dr. Jones had scripted, but he was clearly growing impatient. "Have you ever had a bad baby girl before?" Fry asked. Reflected in the window, Sparks could see Fleur raise a hand to urge caution. "Yes." "Was it a real baby girl, or like me?" "I like both, Goldie." Dr. Jones signaled for him to get back on the agreed track. They were going too fast, but it felt like Taylor was ready to open up. "Tell me about the other bad baby girls. What did you do with them?" And Glenn Taylor told her. He told her about his nightly adventures online, his encounters, his disappointments and triumphs. "But you've never done it for real? In real life?" Dan asked, and all three of them in the room held their breath. "Would you like that, Goldie?" Sparks went to put up his hand, but Fry was already typing. "Yes, I'd like that very much." "He had," he said. "He had found a real baby girl once." Sparks wavered. It was happening too fast to think straight. He looked at Fleur Jones, and she got out of her chair and stood behind her protege. Fry could barely type. He was shaking so hard. "I'm really turned on. Tell me about the real baby girl." "Her name began with B, like mine," Big Bear said. "Can you guess?" "No. You tell me." The silence suffocated them as the seconds ticked by, and they waited for the final piece of the confession. "Sorry, Goldie. Got to go. Someone knocking on my door. Speak later." "Shit," Fry said, and put his head on the desk. "I think we've still got him," Sparks said, looking at Dr. Jones. And she nodded firmly. "He's had enough for me." "Let's put it in front of the grown-ups," Sparks said, and got up. "Excellent work, Fry. Really excellent." 6 hours later, the three of them were sitting in the DCI's office, putting up the case for arresting and charging Glenn Taylor. DCI Breakspear listened carefully, read the transcripts, and made some notes before sitting back to give his judgment.
"He never used the name Bella," he said.
"No, he didn't," Sparks began.
"Did Fry go too far in his prompts?"
"We've talked to the legal team, and at first glance they're comfortable with it. It's always a fine balance, isn't it?"
"But," Breakspear talked over him, "we have him talking about taking a real baby girl with a name beginning with B. Let's get him back in and put it to him. Say we have a witness statement from Goldilocks."
The room nodded.
"We've got very good reasons to have pursued this line. We've got him in the area on the day, the blue van, the child porn on his computer, his predatory nature shown in his chatroom outings, a shaky alibi from his wife.
And key is the risk of further offences. The room nodded again.
Do you believe he's our man, Bob? Breakspear asked finally.
Yes, I do,
Sparks croaked, his mouth dried by anticipation.
So do I. But we need more to nail it down. Fine-tooth comb, Bob. Do it all again while we've got him in. There must be something linking him to the scene.
The team were sent back up the M3 to the South London suburb to start afresh.
Bring everything he has ever worn, Sparks said. Everything. Just empty the cupboards.
It was pure chance that they picked up Jean Taylor's black puffer jacket. It was wedged between her husband's winter coat and a dress shirt, and was bagged and tagged like everything else. The technician who received the bags stacked them according to type and started the tests on outerwear, as it was likely to come into contact with the crime victim first. The jacket pockets were emptied and contents bagged. There was only one item, a scrap of red paper about as big as the technician's thumbnail. In the hush of the laboratory, he went through the process of examining it for fingerprints and fibres, lifting any evidence with sticky tape and cataloguing it meticulously. No prints, but dirt particles and what looked like an animal hair. Finer than a human hair, but he'd need to look at it under the microscope to get details of colour and species. He took off his gloves and walked to the phone on the wall.
D.I. Sparks, please.
Sparks jumped down the stairs, two at a time. The technician had told him not to bother coming.
It's too early to be sure of anything, sir.
But Sparks just wanted to see the piece of paper. To reassure himself it was real and wasn't going to disappear in a puff of smoke.
We're comparing the dirt particles with those taken from Glenn Taylor's van in the original sweep,
the technician told him calmly.
If there's a match, we can place the paper in the van and we can tell you what sort of paper it is, sir.
It's a bit of a Skittles packet, Sparks said. Look at the colour. Get on with it, man. Do you know what sort of animal the hair comes from? Could it be a cat?
The technician put up a hand.
I can tell you if it's a cat quite quickly. I'll get it under the microscope. But we can't say if it came from a specific animal. It's not like humans. Even if we have hairs to compare it with, we can't say definitively that it came from that specific animal. Furthest we can go, if we're lucky, is that it came from the same breed.
Sparks ran both hands through his hair.
Get samples from Timmy Elliott pronto and let's see.
He hovered, and the technician waved him out the door.
Give us some time, and I'll ring you as soon as we have results.
Back in his office, he and Matthews drew a Venn diagram, putting all the potential new evidence in interconnecting circles to see where they were. If the paper is from a Skittles packet and the hair is from a cat, the same breed as Timmy, it could place Jean Taylor at the scene, Matthew said. It's her coat, must be. It's too small for Glenn.
I'll go and get her, Sparks said.
Chapter 25 The Widow Thursday, July 12th, 2007. Of course, the police don't give up. They've got their teeth into Glenn with his van, his pretend child porn, and his misconduct. They'll never let him go. They'll try to prosecute him for those pictures, if nothing else, his solicitor says. The visits and phone calls from D.I. Sparks become part of our lives. The police are building a case, and we watch from the sidelines. I say to Glenn that he should just tell the police about the private job and where he was that day, but he insists it would make things worse. They'll say we've lied to them about everything, Jeannie. I'm terrified I'll do something to make things worse, say the wrong thing, but in the end, it was Glenn who let the side down, not me. The police came to get him for further questioning today. They took him back to Southampton. When they left, he kissed me on the cheek and told me not to worry. You know it'll be all right, he said to me, and I nodded, and I waited. The police collected more of Glenn's things, all the clothes and shoes they hadn't taken before. They took things he'd only just bought. I tried to tell them, but they said they were taking everything. They even took my jacket by mistake. I'd hung it in his space in the wardrobe because my side was full. The next day Bob Sparks came and asked me to go with him down to Southampton for questioning. He wouldn't say anything in the car, just that he wanted me to help with the inquiry. But when we got in the police station, he sat me in an interview room and read me my rights. Then he asked me if I had taken Bella. Had I helped Glenn take Bella? I couldn't believe he would ask me that. I kept saying, "No, of course not. And Glenn didn't take her." But he wasn't listening properly. He was moving to the next thing. He pulled out this plastic bag like a conjurer. I couldn't see anything in it at first, but at the bottom was a scrap of red paper. "We found this in your coat pocket, Mrs. Taylor. It's from a Skittles packet. Do you eat many Skittles?" I didn't know what he was talking about for a moment, but then I remembered. It must have been the bit of sweet packet I'd got from under the mat in the van. He must have seen my face change and kept pushing me, kept saying Bella's name. I said I couldn't remember, but he knew I could. I told him in the end, to stop him asking me. I told him it might be a bit of paper I'd found in the van, just a bit of rubbish, all fuzzy and dirty, and put it in my pocket to throw away later, but never did. I said it was just a sweet paper. But Mr. Sparks said they'd found a cat hair stuck to it. A grey cat hair. Like from the cat in Bella's garden. I said that didn't prove anything. The hair could have come from anywhere. But I had to make a statement. I hoped they wouldn't say anything to Glenn before I got a chance to explain. I'd tell him when we both got home that they made me tell them. That it didn't matter. But I didn't get the opportunity. Glenn didn't come home. Seems he went on looking for porn on the internet. I couldn't believe he'd be so stupid when Tom Payne told me. He was always the clever one in the family. The police had taken his computer, of course, but he bought himself a cheap little laptop and a Wi-Fi router. For work, Jeannie. And sat in the spare room while he went into sex chat rooms, or whatever they're called. It was all very clever. They got some police officer to pretend to be a young woman on the internet and chat him up. She called herself Goldilocks. Who would fall for that? Well, Glenn, apparently. It wasn't just chatting up, either. Tom wanted to prepare me for what might be in the papers. So he told me that eventually Goldilocks had cyber sex with Glenn. "It's sex without touching," Glenn tried to explain when I visited him the first time. "It's just words, Jeannie. Written down words. We didn't speak or even see each other. It was like it was happening in my head, just a fantasy. You do see, don't you? I'm under such a lot of stress with all these accusations. I can't help myself." I tried to see. I really did. It was an addiction, I kept saying to myself. Not his fault. I focused on the real villains here. Glenn and I were very angry about what the police did. I couldn't believe someone would do that as part of their job. Like a prostitute. That's what Glenn said, before he found out Goldilocks was a man. That was hard for him to accept. He thought the police were just saying it to make him look like he was gay or something. I said nothing. I couldn't get my head around cyber sex, let alone worry about who he was doing it with. Anyway, it was hardly his biggest problem. He'd said too much to Goldilocks. Glenn told me he'd told her he knew something about a famous police case to impress her. She practically told him to say it. This time, Bob Sparks charged Glenn with Bella's kidnapping. They said he'd taken her and killed her. But they didn't charge him with murder. Tom Payne, his lawyer, said they were waiting until they had a body. I hated him talking about Bella like that, but I didn't say anything. I went home alone, and then the press came back. I wasn't a big newspaper reader, really. I preferred magazines, I like the real-life stories. You know, the woman who fostered 100 kids, the woman who refused cancer treatment to save her baby, the woman who had a baby for her sister. The papers were more Glenn's department. He liked the Daily Mail. He could do the crossword on the back page. And it was the sort of paper his former boss at the bank read. "Gives us something in common, Jeannie," he said once. But now, the papers and the telly, and even the radio, were about us. Glenn was big news, and the reporters started knocking on the door again. I found out they called it doorstepping, and some of them actually slept in their cars outside all night to try to catch a word with me. I used to sit upstairs in our bedroom at the front, peeking out from behind the curtain, watching them. They all did the same thing. It was quite funny, really. They would drive past first, checking out the house and who was already outside. Then they parked and strolled back to the gate, a notebook in their hand. The others would jump out of their cars to cut the new one off before they could get to the door, like a pack of animals, sniffing around the new arrival. After a few days, they were all friends, sending one to get coffees and bacon sandwiches from the cafe at the bottom of the hill. Sugar? Who wants sauce? The cafe must have made a fortune. I noticed the reporters kept to one group and the photographers to another. Wonder why they didn't mix. You could tell them apart, because the photographers dressed differently. Trendier, in scruffy jackets and baseball caps. Most of them looked like they hadn't shaved for days. The men, I mean. The women photographers dressed like men too, in chinos and baggy shirts. And the photographers were so loud. I felt a bit sorry for the neighbours at first, having to listen to them laughing and carrying on. But then they started bringing out trays of drinks, standing and chatting with them, and letting them use their loos. It was a bit of a street party for them, I think. The reporters were quieter. They spent most of their time on their phones or sitting listening to the radio news in their cars. Lots were young blokes in their first suits. But after a few days, when I wouldn't talk, the press sent the big guns. Big beery men and women with sharp faces and smart coats. They rolled up in their expensive shiny cars and stepped out like royalty. Even the photographers stopped messing about for some of them. One man who looked like he'd stepped out of a shop window parted the crowd and walked up the path. He banged on the door and called out, "Mrs. Taylor, what is it like to have a child murderer as a husband?" I sat there on the bed, burning with shame. I felt like everyone could see me, even though they couldn't. Exposed. Anyway, he wasn't the first to ask me that. One reporter shouted it at me the day after Glenn was charged, as I was walking down to the shops. He just appeared, must have followed me away from the other journalists. He was trying to make me angry, to get me to say something, anything, so he'd have an interview with the wife. But I wasn't falling for that. Glenn and I discussed it before he was put in prison on remand. "Jeannie, just stay quiet," he said. "Don't let them get to you. Don't let anything show. You don't have to talk to them. They are scum. They can't write about nothing." But of course they did. The stuff that came out was awful. Other women said they'd had cybersex with him on the internet and were queuing up to sell their stories. I couldn't believe any of it was true. Apparently he was called Big Bear and other ridiculous names in the chat rooms. I would look at him sometimes on my prison visits and try to imagine calling him Big Bear. It made me feel sick. And there was more stuff about his hobby. The pictures he bought on the net. According to informed sources in one of the papers, he'd used a credit card to buy them. And when the police did a big swoop on paedophiles, tracking them through their card details, he panicked. I expect that's why he got me to report it missing. But how do papers get information like that? I thought about asking one of the reporters, but I can't, without saying more than I should. When I asked Glenn about it at our next visit, he denied it all. "They're just making it up, love. The press makes it all up. You know they do," he said, holding my hand. "I love you," he said. I didn't say anything. I didn't say anything to the press either. I went to different supermarkets, so they couldn't find me, and started wearing hats that hid my face a bit, so other people wouldn't recognize me. Like Madonna, Lisa would have said if she was still my friend. But she wasn't. No one wanted to know us now. They just wanted to know about us.
Chapter 26. The Detective. Monday, February 11th, 2008. The incident room had been packed up 4 months before the trial. Walls and whiteboards were stripped, and the mosaic of photos and maps dismantled and packed into cardboard box files for the prosecution. When the last box had been taken out, Sparks stood and looked at the faint rectangles left on some of the walls. "Barely a trace that the investigation ever took place," he mused. This moment, in any case, was a bit like post-coital tristesse, he'd once told Eileen.
"Post-what?" she'd asked.
"You know, that sad feeling after sex that it's all over," he'd explained, adding sheepishly, "I read about it in a magazine."
"Must be a man thing," she'd said.
The final interviews with Taylor had been long and ultimately frustrating. He disputed the sweet paper evidence, sweeping it aside as coincidence.
"How do you know Jean didn't get it wrong? She could have picked it up in the street or in a cafe."
"She says she found it in your van, Glenn. Why would she say that if it wasn't true?" Taylor's mouth had hardened. "She's under a lot of pressure."
"And the cat hair on the paper? Hair from exactly the same type of cat that Bella was playing with that day?
For God's sake, how many grey cats are there in this country? This is ridiculous." Taylor turned to his lawyer.
"That hair could have been floating around anywhere, couldn't it, Tom?"
Sparks paused, savoring the rare note of panic in Taylor's voice. Then he moved on to what he anticipated would be the coup de grâce, the moment when Taylor realized he'd been seen and played by the police.
"So, Big Bear, then, Mr. Taylor," Sparks said.
Taylor's mouth had fallen open, then snapped shut.
"Don't know what you're talking about."
"You've been down in the woods, looking for friends. Finding friends, haven't you? But we've met Goldilocks, too."
Taylor's feet started tapping, and he stared at his lap, his default position. At his side, Tom Paine looked mystified by the turn in the questions and interrupted. "I'd like a few moments with my client, please." 5 minutes later, the pair had their story straight. "It was a private fantasy between two consenting adults," Glenn Taylor said. "I was under a lot of stress."
"Who was the baby girl with a name beginning with B, Glenn?"
"It was a private fantasy between two consenting adults."
"Was it Bella?"
"It was a private fantasy.
What have you done with Bella?"
"It was a private fantasy."
When they charged him, he stopped mumbling about his private fantasy and looked the detective in the eye.
"You're making a terrible mistake, Mr. Sparks."
It was the last thing he said before he was locked up to await trial. A winter on remand did not persuade him to cooperate, and on February 11th, 2008, Glenn Taylor stood in the Old Bailey to deliver his plea of not guilty to abduction in a loud and steady voice. He sat down, barely acknowledging the prison officers on either side as he fixed his gaze on the detective inspector making his way to the witness box. Sparks felt the power of Taylor's stare boring into the back of his head and tried to collect himself before he took the oath. There was the slightest of tremors in his voice as he spoke the words on the card, but he went on to give his evidence in chief competently, keeping his answers short, clear, and humble. The months of foot slogging, chasing, heavy lifting, checking, questioning, and stacking up the evidence were condensed into a short performance before a small and select audience
and a battery of critics. Chief among them was Glenn Taylor's defence barrister, a patrician warhorse in ancient fraying wig and gown, who stood up to cross-examine him. The jury of 8 men and 4 women, winnowed by the defence to ensure male sensibilities and sympathies were in the majority, turned their heads like a patch of sunflowers to focus on him. The barrister, Charles Sanderson, QC, stood with one hand in his pocket, his notes in the other. He exuded confidence as he began his attempt to undermine some of the nuggets of evidence and plant doubt in the jury's collective consciousness.
When did the witness, Mr. Spencer, make a note about the blue van? Was it before he fabricated the long-haired man sighting? Mr. Spencer was mistaken about the sighting. He has admitted that, Sparks said, keeping his voice level. Yes, I see. His evidence will be that he wrote down that he saw what he thought was Peter Treadwell's blue van when he made his notes on the afternoon of October the 2nd. And he is sure he didn't make a mistake about seeing a blue van? Yes, he is sure. He will tell you himself when he gives evidence. I see. Now, how far away was the witness when he saw the blue panel van? And does Mr. Spencer wear glasses? I see. And how many blue panel vans are there on the road in the UK, Inspector? I see. It was the I sees